Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Snafu. Please visit our website and our Patreon page for bonus content such as pictures of the characters, maps of the airfield, Q&A episodes, and much, much more. This podcast contains explicit content. They may not be suitable for some audience members. Listener's discretion is advised. Rosie and Andy were standing outside the Jeep depot, waiting for an upper brassman to come and grab a Jeep and head into town. The air was cold and dry. Rosie was used to the cold temperature since he was from New York, but Andy was struggling with the cold winter air. Andy had both hands in his pockets, and his teeth were chattering.
It's cold out here, Andy said.
Yes, it is, Rosie replied.
You don't look like you're cold.
Yeah. Have you ever been to Brooklyn in January?
No.
Well, if you had, you know why. This is nothing.
I'm telling you, if I piss right now, I swear an ice cube will come out.
That's taking it too far. It's not that cold.
No, I'm being serious.
You mean to tell me that it never got that cold up in Connecticut?
I mean, it does, but I grew up in the South. I avoided going outside when I was at Yale.
Anything else you avoided while you were there? Social interaction? Anything?
What the hell are you saying?
Nothing. I'll give it 2 more minutes, Andy, before we head back to the hut.
Rosie, you can't give up. We need to go.
Don't give me that crap. We're standing out here because of you. You told him you didn't want to go into town tonight, and then you said you did.
Well, that's because I realized that if I stayed here, I'd be stuck with you and Captain Blue and the rest of his ass faces.
Ass faces. And you went to Yale. You baffle me. Doesn't matter, Andy. You were the one who told him to go ahead without us because you had to go back to the hut.
Well, I didn't realize that they got the last troop truck into town.
It doesn't matter. What was so important you had to go back anyways?
Nothing.
Nothing? You mean to tell me that we're standing out here for nothing?
Well, technically, the boss made you stay behind.
The babysit. He told me to stay and help babysit you because you're like a fucking child.
It's not very nice.
What did you have to grab?
Nothing.
Andy!
Okay. I was going back to find something for the boss.
What was it?
I told you, it was nothing.
It was enough that you had to go back and make us miss our chance.
Okay, I went back to put on some of his cologne.
What?
Yeah, I like his cologne, and I personally don't have any of my own, and I wanted to smell good for tonight. It's the first time we're going out.
Why didn't you just ask him? Rosie asked.
I don't know, I just didn't want to.
Well, it's because of that that we're out here waiting for a driver.
Andy looked over at Rosie and thought the moment was perfect for him to ask his crew member a question that had been plaguing his mind for days.
Rosie, are you at all scared about flying our first mission?
Scared? No. Anxious? Sure. I just wanted to shoot down a Nazi plane and bomb the hell out of Hitler's cities. I just wanted this whole thing to be over with.
Andy pondered Rosie's answer and then asked him, "So what do you think it's going to be like up there?" Rosie paused, leaving enough time that Andy considered asking the question again, thinking Rosie didn't hear him or understand the question. But before he could, Rosie answered by saying, "Unforgettable."
"Unforgettable? Wasn't expecting that answer," Andy replied. "What do you think it will be like shooting down a Nazi fighter?"
Rosie paused again before he saw an officer approaching them. As Rosie was getting ready to ask the man to take him into Haverhill, he looked over at Andy and said,
"Personally, I think it will feel like itching a scratch you've had for a long time, but haven't been able to scratch it."
Thank you.
1 month later, April 3rd, 1944, United States Army Air Force Station 186, Thurlow, England, 0623. The sun was over the horizon, providing a much-needed light on the 18 armed-and-ready B-17s awaiting at their hard stands. The sky was clear, light clouds were above them, a rarity in England. The temperature was a nice and refreshing 44 degrees, and the humidity was low, perfect conditions to fly a mission. Rosie was sitting in the nose compartment of Loaded Bull. Most of the damage from the previous mission had been repaired and patched. However, there were a few exceptions, especially in the nose. Four small holes were still visible above the right cheek gun, since Butch didn't have enough time to patch these holes. They served as a grim reminder to both Rosie and Andy as they awaited for the mission to go underway. The target for today was to a rail junction in Ghent, Belgium. The trip was over 400 miles long, and the mission was expected to take a little over 4 hours to complete. The 300th would be flying in the second group of the four-group formation. In that second group, the 300th would be flying in the high wing, and the 530th Squadron would be flying in the low squadron. Leading the 530th Squadron was the new 530th Squadron commander, Major Anthony Texas McCormick, and the rest of his crew of From Texas With Love. Flying off to their right to the number 2 spot would be Brolin and the rest of Hailing Mary. Flying to the left of Texas in the number 3 spot would be Ronnie and Mickey, flying in Hellfire from above. Flying down the number 4 spot, nestled behind and under Hailing Mary in Texas, would be the Boss and the rest of Loaded Bull. Flying off to their right to the number 5 spot would be Fenway Bombshell, flown by Parnell and his crew. Flying off to the Bull's left side in the number 6 spot was the crew of Dropping Deuces, which of course was flown by Hill House. The formation was expected to face light flak in light fighter opposition, and this was backed up more with the fact that the formation would be escorted by two squadrons of P-51Cs to and from the target. The rail junction they were sent to bomb today was a known target, since the 300 had bombed it 3 times since last summer. The last time they bombed it was in early February, and even though 80% of the bombs hit the target, intelligence informed the 8th Air Force that the rail junction was fully repaired and operating again. This wasn't the only target that the 300th had bombed more than once after hitting the target. This was a fact that men like Leslie reminded Jack and the others of when he was told where his friends would be flying that morning. This fact was all the more reason why morale on the base was extremely low. Nearly every airman was rocked with the news of the tours being extended from 25 to 30 missions. When Rosie heard the news, he felt rather indifferent to it, since he saw it as more opportunities to help bring the war to an end. He didn't understand why so many men wasted their time looking to finish their tour as some guiding light or goal, when it was clear and apparent that their chances of them finishing their tour from the start was stacked up against them. After Berlin, Rosie accepted that he was more than likely not going to finish his tour, and found comfort in it. This was due to the fact that he wasn't afraid of death. What he was afraid of was the thought of returning home crippled or mangled without finishing his tour. This was a fear that most of the men had, but with them, fear of death was more paramount. On the other hand, Andy was becoming more and more deeply depressed over the news. He was one of many airmen who felt that his chances of making it through 30 missions was slim to none, and with each passing mission, his chances were only getting worse and worse. The rumor on the base was that the 300th would be flying to targets like Berlin, Hamburg, Frankfurt, Bremen, etc. more and more frequently due to the noticeable change in attitude coming from the upper brass. Men like Leslie and Bernhausen remembered earlier in the year that the brass stayed away from targets deep inside Nazi-fortified Europe, maybe having one deep penetrating mission a month. Most of the targets that they flew were along the Atlantic coast or close to it. However, since Big Week, the missions had been getting more deep inside behind enemy lines, with less and less care and concern having been felt or shown when high losses occurred. To the enlisted men, the news confirmed what most of them had already suspected. The United States was getting more desperate, and the pressure was on. This was backed up more when the men saw more and more military personnel in places like Haverhill
that were not related to engineers or airmen. Something big was on the horizon. Today, filling in for Skimpy was a replacement radio man named Cecil Jones from Scranton, Pennsylvania. Cecil was 22 years old and had flown a total of 16 missions before he was injured on a mission to Bremen in late February. While he was in the hospital, he was informed that his crew was shot down on the last day of Big Week, and since then, he had filled in for crews all throughout the 300th. Cecil was average height, had longer brown hair, a wide nose, spaced-out teeth, and pale skin. This morning was the first time that men from the Bull had ever met Cecil, and he seemed to fit in rather well with them. Accompanying Cecil on the mission, as another replacement, was Mills' replacement, 19-year-old Alex Crest of San Francisco, California. Men like Willie and Tommy were familiar with Alex, for he had flown missions with Deuces and Cap'n Kids before. He had 19 missions under his belt, and also lost his crew while he was healing up at a hospital after a mission. Alex was short, at least by comparison to Beans, and he was very quiet. He wasn't quiet like Rob from Hellfire was, but he was quiet like Skimpy was. Beans attempted to try to talk to Alex, but it was met with short answers and little interaction. Men like Alex were not in the business of getting to know more people than he already knew. This was something that Beans and the others were aware of and understanding of. The rest of the men were all in their sitting positions along with the two replacement gunners and were preparing for takeoff. Up in the cockpit, Jack and the boss had finished their pre-flight checklists and were now awaiting to see the green flare. Jack sat quietly, taking glaring looks down at his watch. The boss also sat quietly, going over the mission in his head, having memorized the flight path and changing altitudes. He told the men before they boarded the Bull that he expected everyone to be on their guard today and that the brass would be paying close attention to them. Of course, none of the men knew exactly what he meant, but they understood that the boss was calling for them to be above reproach today. The boss then looked down at his watch and saw the time. 4 minutes till takeoff. It seemed like a lifetime away. Back in the nose, Rosie was now looking over his target photos, studying them with such concentration. The target sat in the northern section of the city. It wouldn't be hard to find. The aiming point was in the center of the rail junction, and the planes were carrying 36 250-pound general-purpose bombs designed to destroy rail cars, rail lines, and finally, the complex at the northern end of the target. The complex sat next to the bottleneck, where all 33 railways converged into one of three rail lines. If knocked out, things such as troops, supplies, and equipment being sent to German troop lines all over Europe would be halted. Then, suddenly, the green flare was fired, and one by one, the engines of the 18 green-painted beasts began roaring, echoing throughout the English countryside. Several minutes later, the boss and Jack helped to move the Bull down the perimeter track, circling the airfield, following the long line of bombers, all headed to the northern end of Runway 1. The lead plane that day would be Roosevelt's Revenge, a B-17 from the 528 Squadron, whose plane had 29 missions and 8 Nazi fighter kills credited to its name. Two other crew members were now tied with Leslie and his crew, with 20 to 22 sorties flown, the highest in the 300 so far. Roosevelt's Revenge turned right on Runway 1 and awaited there. The Bull, on the other hand, was left idling next to Hangar 2 on the northern end of the airfield, which was surrounded by hard stands which belonged to the 528 Squadron. Soon, the second green flare was shot into the air, and Roosevelt's Revenge roared down the runway and lifted into the sky. One by one, B-17s followed its path, and soon, it was the Bull's turn. The B-17 turned to the south and was now facing the living quarters, hospital, and other buildings. The boss and Jack both raised the throttle, and soon, the Bull was heading down the runway and lifted up into the air. Rosie in the nose watched as the enlisted men's barracks, hospital, and high brass hall passed underneath them. Once in the air, the Bull circled the airfield and slowly fell into formation. Within an hour, the 300th Bombardment Group headed to the assembly point and would be joined by the 380th and the 306th Bomb Group.
Do you love vintage warbirds? Do you love drinking good coffee? Would you love to be able to help keep warbirds in the sky by just drinking coffee every single morning? Well, believe it or not, you can by going to www.warbirdcoffeecompany.com and signing up for a bag of great tasting fresh roasted coffee. Guys, this is a veteran-owned and operated business that I discovered back in July. Let me tell you something, I drink so much of the stuff that you could say that Snafu runs off of Warbird Coffee Company. These guys partner up with operators and museums, and for every bag of coffee sold, they give back to their partners to help keep the memory of the greatest generation alive. They're available for everyone living in the United States and Great Britain. If you want to find out more about who they are and what they do, go to one of their social media pages by just searching up Warbird Coffee Company, and get this, if you use the promo code SNAFU20, again, SNAFU20, you will get 20% off any product that you buy from Warbirds, and if that's not enough, you can get 15% off your first order by visiting and subscribing to their website, www.warbirdcoffeecompany.com. Do you like war movies? Do they get your blood going? If so, I have the perfect podcast for you. This is not an affiliation. This isn't like we're sponsoring them. They're sponsoring us, so I got to mention them. This is just me strictly telling you about a podcast I love. The podcast is called Danger Close. It's a war film podcast where three hosts, a theater director, a movie critic, and a veteran, come together each week to talk about a different war movie. Guys, this is a fantastic podcast. If you want to get into war films on just more than just a surface level, this is perfect. The hosts are phenomenal. The research is impeccable, and the quality of it is just phenomenal. I can't recommend this enough. So if you guys enjoy podcasts, you want more podcasts to make your day go by faster at work, or you wanted something to listen to while you're cleaning house or trying to fall asleep or you're driving in the car, guys, this is a perfect podcast to listen to. Danger Close, check it out for yourself. If you do, go onto the discussion page on Facebook and tell them that Aaron from Canso 34 Studios and Snafu Podcast sent you. Thank you guys so much. Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by visiting our website, www.snafupod.net, you can find all kinds of amazing free, it's important, free resources to help you find out more about the 8th Air Force in World War II and about the B-17 Flying Fortress. Right now, you can take a virtual tour of two real B-17s like the ones depicted in Snafu. Also, you can find links to movies, documentaries, and free YouTube videos, and much more. All you have to do is visit www.snafupod.net and check it out for yourself. Now, back to the podcast. Two and a half hours had passed since the Bull lifted off the runway in Thurlow. It was now 23,000 feet above the coastal town of Vern, Belgium, which was just 15 miles east of Dunkirk. Small puffs of flak were seen down below from the coast, letting the formation know that they were not welcome. In the nose, Andy sat at his navigator's desk and called over the intercom.
Okay, boss. We're at the decision point. Heading to the target is 0-9-5. Again, that's 0-9-5. Roger that. How are we looking down there, Rosie?
The boss asked.
Skies are pretty clear.
Rosie replied.
Good. All right, men. We're in enemy territory. Keep your eyes open for fighters and call them in when you see them. Save your ammunition and make your shots count. Let's rid the world of another Kraut plane.
Jack said.
I hear that.
Willie replied in his top turret as the plane banked and turned with the other planes in the formation. Once they turned, the men of the Bull were silent, awaiting for the attacks to occur. Looking up, the boss could see Texas above him, with his tail section only being in front of them by 100 feet, and above their left wing by 80 or so feet. From Jack's perspective, looking up, Hailing Mary was too close for his comfort. Brolin's tail was hovering just 50 feet above their right wing, and Jack was able to see Brolin's ball turret gunner inside his turret. They were that close. Texas was a master at flying tight formation, and so was Brolin. In fact, the boss personally struggled to keep up with the two planes, since they flew so steadily and straight that they seemed to be hardly moving. In the tail, Pally was sitting at his gunner seat and was observing the beautiful landscape that was laid below him. Seeing the Belgium coast float by was breathtaking, even with the current dangers. As he observed the world around him, he saw black specks coming from down below. Pally called them in.
Bandits coming in, 6 o'clock low.
Suddenly, the men inside the bull tensed up and prepared themselves for the fight. Within 5 minutes, the specks got closer and closer to the formation. The specks turned out to be 3 squadrons of FW-190s, and less than half of them engaged the Little Friends as they dove downward to meet the attack. Pally aimed his guns at the 2 incoming 190s and soon began firing upon them. While no bullets landed any hits, Pally's bullets and several others from bombers caused the 190s to divert their attacks elsewhere. For the next few minutes, the 190s focused their attacks on the back of the formation. One 190 was able to bring down a B-17 flying in Group 4, causing it to crash into another B-17, and the two heavies were sent down towards Earth. A minute or so later, Tommy called in.
190 coming in, 7 o'clock low, watch it!
As Tommy opened fire on the fighter, that's when Alex saw a 190 coming up in the range and began firing upon it. One of his bullets struck the fighter's tail section, but before any bullets could hit the German fighter, a waist gunner from Deuces landed a fatal hit and the 190 was turned into a fireball. Tommy then called in the downed fighter.
Who got it?
Willie asked.
Not sure. Alex?
Tommy asked.
Looked like the left waist gunner.
Alex responded.
Oh, right up Tella!
Willie exclaimed over the intercom.
Enough with the chatter. Call out those fighters.
The boss said.
Oh yeah, sorry, boss.
Willie retorted.
190's coming around, 4 o'clock high, watch it.
Beans called in.
I see them,
said Alex as he fired his gun.
190 coming in hot, 6 o'clock high.
Cecil called in.
I see him,
added Willie as he fired his guns. Jack up in the cockpit saw one 190 heading towards them from the 2 o'clock position. Panicking, Jack called in.
Shit, 2 o'clock! Fighter, 190!
The 190 buzzed towards the formation and soon, its guns were lighting up and hot metal was being sent in the bull's direction. Bullets tore into the bull's number 3 and 4 engines, and the 190 banked hard to his right and disappeared under the bull.
Jesus, that was close. Engine number 3 and 4 hit.
Jack said, looking down at his engine controls to see if they were affected by the hits. So far, they seemed fine.
Andy, did you not see him?
The boss asked.
Sorry, my gun's jammed.
Andy called back.
Do you need help?
The boss asked.
No, I'll be fine. Just working on it now.
Andy claimed. Over the next 3 minutes, while Andy was working on his guns, the 190s changed their attacks towards the front of the formation. The Little Friends had tied down half the remaining fighters from attacking the formation, and Pally observed the intense dogfighting. The 190s then arrived ahead of the formation and quickly turned in towards it.
Here they come,
called out Andy as he headed over to his left cheek gun.
I got my sights on him,
Rosie remarked, aiming his sights on the incoming fighters. Soon the group approached the formation and began firing their guns. As bullets zipped past the bull and the others, Rosie remained in his almost calm-like state and aimed his guns at the 190 that was making an attack on Hailing Mary. Rosie could see Coca's guns going off in the direction of the incoming fighter, and could see the tracers coming close, but landing no hits. Since the other 190s were diverting their attacks on other bombers, Rosie opened fire on the 190 attacking Hailing Mary, and was stunned when his first 3 shots zipped past Hailing Mary's left wing and struck the 190 right in the cockpit and behind the cockpit. The plane continued its path but stopped firing. Soon the 190 flew right past Hailing Mary and began slowly arching downward, missing Hailing Mary's underside by less than 50 or so feet.
I got one. Son of a bitch, I got one. He did, I saw it.
Andy confirmed.
Hey, Rosie, welcome to the club,
said Willie. Rosie was overwhelmed with emotion as he continued to scan the skies for more planes. It felt good. It felt cathartic for him. He had caught and killed his first white whale. Then Rosie saw another 190 coming into attack and aimed his guns and began firing upon it. Bullets ripped into the fighter's rudder and vertical stabilizer, and before Rosie could see what the fighter's fate was, it disappeared underneath the bull.
I think I got another one,
Rosie called in.
I saw it. He's still going,
Tommy said, disappointing Rosie. As the fighters moved on to attack planes further back in the formation, Rosie sat in reflection of his achievement. He couldn't believe it. He would now have a German swastika added to his plane's compartment, showing that he had knocked down a German plane. He was so excited that he immediately began thinking about what he was going to write to his parents. How would he describe the feeling that he was now experiencing?
Fighters are leaving, I think.
Pally said as he watched the remaining 190s leave the formation, with the escort fighters falling shortly behind. Before the fighters left the range of the bomber's guns, flak began appearing off in the distance. Andy was the first one to call it in. Soon, light to medium flak surrounded the formation, and within the next 2 minutes, the formation arrived at the IP. Rosie then announced to the group,
"Bomb doors opening."
In the waste compartment, Beans watched as Alex stood next to his gunner's opening, looking completely unfazed by the minor flak barrage. While Beans wasn't as tense as he had been on previous missions, flak was still flak, and even with light to medium levels of flak going off around them, Beans was still sweating from fear and anxiety. Alex, on the other hand, seemed like he was on a Sunday car ride. Beans also noticed that Alex had a look in his eye as he looked out at the world below him that signaled that he was in deep thought. Was he thinking about his lost crew? Was he looking at planes and crews that he had previously flown missions with getting shot up? Beans then looked over at the radio room and saw that Cecil was sitting in Skimpy's radio desk, looking over something. He looked unfazed by the flak as well, and it was weird for him to see someone else occupying the space in the radio room that wasn't Skimpy.
60 seconds to target,
Rosie called in over the intercom. From where he was sitting, Rosie kept looking down through the bomb sight, hoping to catch the target before he had to release the bomb toggle. Sure enough, he was able to spot the target with ease as they were approaching it. From 23,000 feet, Rosie was able to make out the long lines of trail cars and locomotives parked at the depot. Then the thought occurred to him. What if those trains had prisoners in them? What if the complex or warehouse were full of POWs or prisoners like his aunt and uncle? Before Rosie could give any more thought to this, he saw bombs falling from all the B-17s in the formation, and so he flicked the toggle switch, releasing his bombs.
Bombs away!
Rosie called out. Down in the ball turret, Tommy watched as bombs fell from every bomber in the formation. The sight was breathtaking. However, there was one thing that he witnessed that shook him up. Down in the 381st's low squadron, a B-17 flew out of his formation spot, and he flew directly in the path of bombs falling from a plane in the 306th low squadron. A single bomb landed right in the nose section of the fortress, and soon was followed by a second bomb, which landed right on top of the cockpit. The damaged B-17, which was still having bombs falling from its bomb bay, plunged down towards Earth, and after Tommy called it in, Tommy watched as the bomber crashed into the Belgium countryside. Tommy then watched as 7,776 250-pound bombs slammed into the target area. Within seconds, the entire area, which used to be a train station, a depot, and junction, was reduced to rubble, and the landscape now resembled that of an alien planet.
Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by becoming a supporter of the podcast, you will receive bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, pictures and maps of the airfield and surrounding areas, as well as formation breakdowns of past, present, and future missions, and Q&A episodes. There is so much for you to gain by donating $3 or $10 to help support the podcast. If you would like to be a part of Snafu each week, please visit our Patreon page. The link for that's down in the show notes. Any support goes a long way in helping the podcast to continue. In fact, to give a shout out to those who are supporting this podcast, we want to thank Fernando, Reinhold, Benita, Kyle, and Cedric. Thank you guys so much for all your support and your helping this podcast to continue. Your contribution is making a huge difference. Now, back to the podcast. The formation arrived back at Thurlow around 11 o'clock, and the last plane landed at 12:04. The 300th hadn't lost a single plane on the mission, however, four airmen were lost due to fighters and flak. Among the 530th squadron, no airmen were lost, although five airmen returned injured. One of them was Fenway's bombardier Nicholas Carnegie, whose flak vest took the impact of a bullet from an incoming fighter. He returned with 9 broken ribs, 3 bruised ribs, a cracked sternum, and internal bleeding. He would be out of commission for over a month. Other than that, the casualties were light,
and the bull returned with only a handful of bullet holes. After the debriefing, many of the officers went to the officers' club for a drink. There, Rosie recounted his story about shooting down a 190 to the other officers. While he did, the boss and Jack sat together at the bar and observed the crew member in all of his glory. "What are the chances that he'll ever stop talking about this?" Jack asked. The boss chuckled and responded, "I don't know. He's been talking about bombing Berlin and shooting down a Nazi for weeks. Well, I should say ever since I met him. Must feel good for him to finally do both." "I know. At least someone feels good about what we're doing," Jack responded. "What do you mean?" the boss asked. "I mean, do you feel like we're making any difference mission after mission?" asked Jack. Of course I do. We're winning a war, Jack. What has Brolin and the others been telling you?" It's not that, but oftentimes when we have missions like to Frankfurt or the one we had today, those were all targets that the 300th has bombed before it," Jack began to say, but was cut off by the boss. "That's because we didn't hit the target 100% the first time." "You see, that's not true, though. That rail junction we bombed today was bombed less than a month ago, and a majority of the bombs went into the pickle barrel. Yet less than 4 weeks later, it was back up and running. I mean, how can we feel like we're doing a good job and we're doing our part to bring the war to an end when the targets that we're bombing are back up and running in just a short period of time?" The boss paused for a moment and thought about what Jack had just said. And then he replied with, "Ask yourself this question, Jack. How much longer will the Germans rebuild and rebuild what we tear down before they run out of material and manpower to rebuild? Not to mention, every time we bomb a rail junction or factory, it slows production and transporting materials for any number of days. Those days are precious if you're fighting a war. If you don't get reinforcements for days, it could cost you a battle or two, and those losses all add up. What we're doing is making some difference. I guess it all depends on how you look at that difference." Jack took a moment to think about what the boss had just said. He understood what he was saying, but he also understood and agreed with what men like Brolin had said to him. Instead of putting any more thought into it, he broke the flow of the moment by saying to the boss, "Listen, I've been meaning to say this officially, but I'm sorry that I'm not the co-pilot you wanted or expected. I've been an ass to you, and maybe I've been a bit altered at times." The boss looked over at Jack, and then he replied with, "Yeah, you have, but I can't blame you, though. I've been a bit of an ass to you as well." Jack was honestly shocked by the boss's statement. He didn't want to say anything as to break up the moment of vulnerability, so he kept quiet, which paid off because the boss then spoke up, furthering his point by saying,
"Do you know what kind of lawyer I was back home, Jack?"
Jack shook his head.
"I specialized in accidents. Your mother-in-law, for example, she would have been one of my clients. My entire career, every single day, was dealing with people whose houses burnt to the ground because of faulty wiring, people who got hurt on the job because someone wasn't paying attention, people who were hurt in an automobile accident because somebody wasn't focusing, someone was distracted. My entire career was built on handling people who went through traumatic experiences. And every single time, I would look at the incident from a 30,000-foot view, and every single time I found myself saying, wow, if that person would have just did their job, if that person would have just focused, if that person would have just done what they were supposed to have done, then all of this pain, all this anguish, all this trouble could have been avoided. But because people are either so consumed with themselves or people are not in it 100%, it causes everybody else's lives to become hell. And whether it was in pilot training or it was in law school or it's flying another mission, I just had this idea in my head that if I did what I was supposed to do, if I did what I was trained to do, if I held everybody else in my crew to the high standard that I set for myself, that if I did that, I'd be able to keep myself and my crew alive. I know that sounds stupid. I know that it probably doesn't make any sense, especially in what we deal with on a day-to-day basis. but I just can't let go of that. I can't seem to get past that. Not to mention, I mean, when Al died, I kept telling myself that wasn't my fault. That's because it wasn't, Jack interrupted. I know it wasn't. It was Al's fault. Al was the one who ran out of ammo. His death was because of him. But for whatever reason, I couldn't blame him. I couldn't get mad at him. So it was easier to blame Skimpy. It was easier to blame everybody else when it was Al who was at fault. Al was the one who wasn't paying attention. Al was the one who wasted ammo. But in that moment, it was just easier to blame Skimpy. And it made sense to me to blame Skimpy. Because in my head, and even a part of me now still wants to believe that even though Al was the one who screwed up, that he would still be alive if Skimpy would have done what I expected him to do. And I see what it did to him. I can see it now. And then I look at people like Rosie. It made sense in the moment that Cobb's death was because of Rosie. And I didn't have the heart to go to Texas and tell him that his navigator was dead because of just chance. In my head, with my background, I just connected the dots and I said, Cobb's death is because of Rosie. And it just felt right to unleash that anger onto him. And I see what it's doing to him. I see what it's continuously doing to him. And it was something that Hill House told me a few weeks ago and has continued to remind me of, that it finally settled in. And that is, he said, that fear always causes itself to come true. And I don't know what it was about the night that we saw that airman hanging from that rafter in the showers, but that entire night, I just kept thinking about Al, Cobb, and everything that has happened to us in the last couple of weeks. I have caused unnecessary amount of shit to go on because of that fear, because of my inability to just look at a situation and see things for what they are, which is that some things happen at random, and that sometimes nobody is at fault. So I guess what I'm trying to say here, Jack, is that I understand what I did to Skimpy, and I understand what I did to people like Rosie. I'm still trying to understand what I did to you, and specifically why I did the things I did to you. Because I'll be honest with you, it makes no sense, I know, but something happened on that mission to Berlin that by the end of it, I was convinced that if something happened to me, if something were to go wrong, and I would not be able to lead the crew, that you would not be able to hold your own, that you would not be able to do what was right and necessary to get the crew back home, that they would not be kept safe if something were to happen to me and it was left up to you. Now, you've proven yourself to people like Hill House. You've proven yourself to people like myself and the rest of our crew. And I don't know why I didn't see that. I don't know why it's taken me forever to figure that out. I'm sorry for what I did to you. I'm sorry for the way I've treated you. I'm sorry for doubting you. Jack sat stunned, looking at the boss. A big grin appeared on his face. He then looked over at the bartender and said, "Hey, Joe, get this guy one more drink. He needs it." Jack then put the money on the bar top. "What are you doing?" the boss asked. "What's it look like I'm doing?" Jack said. "You don't have to do that." "I know. I wanted to. That was mighty big of you to say all that." The boss sat up straight in his chair, looked at Jack with an ornery grin, and said, "Well, now don't ruin it." "Fair enough, fair enough. So, are we okay now?" Jack asked the boss. The boss waited until the bartender arrived back with a glass of whiskey. Once the glass was slid in front of him, the boss threw his arm around Jack's neck, took a sip, and replied with, "Yeah, we're okay." Just then, one of the intelligence officers on the base entered inside the officers' club and walked up to the bar.
Jack and the boss watched as Ronnie, who was sitting with Mickey, Bernhausen, and Merkel, spoke up by asking,
"Well, hey there, Captain Lauder. What, is the high brass hall out of liquor?"
The intelligence officer turned around and replied,
"No, Colonel Poole is in there right now throwing a fucking piss fit over the mission's results today."
"What? What do you mean? What happened?" asked the boss. At this point, every officer inside the hut stopped talking and listened intensely.
"Well, I shouldn't be telling you all this, but what the hell? Since you asked, 70% of the bombs hit the targets today, wiping the rail yard and area completely off the map. It was incredible aiming."
"All right, so what seems to be the problem?"
asked Ronnie. The intelligence officer took in a deep breath, received a glass of ale that the bartender had brought him, and said,
"You know, listen to Lord Haha. He could fill you in. That's how we found out."
After he said this, Texas, who was sitting closest to the radio, changed it to the frequency that Lord Haha was being broadcast on. That's when they caught the tail end of the broadcast, and the men had to wait for it to play all over again. Once it did, they heard the words,
"This is Germany calling, Germany calling. To you Yanks of the 8th Air Force, who bombed the rail yards in Belgium today, you may view that mission as a success. However, keep this in mind. We shot down 3 of your planes and 2 of your escort fighters. If that's not enough, we captured 2 of your airmen who didn't need much to get them to sing. We know all too well that missions across the 8th Air Force have gone up. We know all too well that you have our cities in your sights. And we want you to know this. We'll be waiting for you, flak guns loaded and ready. And if you still view today as a good day's work, we'll have you know that 2 of those trains down there today were full of downed airmen. How many of your sons and brothers did you kill today? Perhaps you should do better intelligence next time you decide to bomb our railways. This is the..."
Texas then shut off the radio, and the men all sat in silence, soaking up the horrific news that they had just heard. Rosie was stunned into shock over the news. He couldn't believe that what went through his mind moments before he released the bombs was actually true. Later that night, the enlisted men were drinking at Bird in Hand. Willie, Tommy, Beans, Pally, Attila, Mason Pointers, and Terrence were all a few beers deep into the night. It was learned that Attila was the one credited with the downed fighter that Alex saw earlier in the mission. Because of that, the men kept buying Attila drinks. Based on how Attila was acting, the men concluded that Attila had never been drunk before. He kept waving his hand in front of his face, which made guys like Willie and Tommy laugh hysterically. The boys all laughed together, and men like Beans felt free and unloaded for a brief moment, enjoying the company of their brothers. Behind the fun and laughter, men like Pally and Tommy could only think about how men like Mills and Skippy were doing. The night didn't feel right without Mills and Skippy being here. On top of that, it was weird going to Bird in Hand without Sarah or Evelyn being next to them. How was it possible that people like Skimpy and Mills could feel so close after only knowing them for less than 2 months? How was it possible that women like Sarah and Evelyn, who seemed to be from a completely different planet, felt like a cousin or sister-in-law to them now? They all were such an important part of their lives that men like Tommy couldn't even comprehend what life would be like without them. Thinking of living another day without them was just simply depressing. Later that night, while the officers were asleep, Rosie laid awake in his bed, staring up at the ceiling. His feelings towards the downed fighter had soured. He wasn't sure if it was due to the bad news, but he felt sick to his stomach. He was starting to grow tired of this war, and he was tired of being surrounded by death. He was tired of the constant tension that he felt inside and outside of the plane. He was getting tired of things getting worse when they should be getting better. For Rosie, his fear of death was still non-existent, but now he wondered if his death and the death of those around him was ever going to be worth something. Just a few days previous, he felt that his death and the death of those around him, people like the boss, Jack, and Andy, that their death would serve some greater purpose, stopping the Germans.
However, he questioned of whether or not this war was ever going to end, because it didn't seem like that was ever going to happen. The Germans didn't seem as weak as the war bond drives back home made them out to be. They were tough, rigid, fierce, and fearless. That one fighter Rosie shot down today, while it felt good in the moment, it now didn't mean anything to him. What good is shooting down one fighter plane when there's 100 more on the ground waiting? What good is it to bomb a target if they get rebuilt within a month's time? All these things Rosie wrestled with as he laid in his bed, hearing the sounds of his friends sleeping. He wondered if any of them felt the same way as he. What Rosie didn't realize was, nobody in the hut that night was sleeping. They were all lying in their beds, pretending to be asleep, while they all came to terms with the possible uselessness of their sacrifice and the possibility that what they were doing was all for nothing. Thank you for listening to episode 17 of Snafu, a historical fiction podcast depicting the average life of a bomber crew in World War II. If you would like more information about the podcast, please visit our website and our Patreon page. Both links are down in the show notes. This podcast is produced by Canso 34 Studios, a DIY project helping to raise awareness to the brave young men who sacrificed their lives in the skies of Europe in World War II. I hope we do it justice. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned next week for episode 19 of Snafu. Remember this.